I suppose you all missed the service 2 hours ago when people set their clocks the wrong way and came. I can never keep it straight, but I guess we're all here, so let's do the best we can to learn from God's Word. It is a bright and early morning because of the sun being up, and what a beautiful day it is. I'd like this morning to learn what we can from a text of Scripture found in Matthew chapter 20. And it's really only 9 verses. And I'm sorry that I have the capacity to fill great amounts of time with small numbers of verses, but we'll see what we can get. I'll try to wring this passage out and look at every single verse and understand all the things that were intended for us to understand from Matthew 20, verses 20 through 28. So hold that for a minute. We'll look at one verse in particular, a little out of order, but then provide the background and details about that text. You should know about Jesus and political power, that when he came into the world, he was notably not involved in politics. It isn't that there weren't things that might need to have been addressed from the standpoint of what we now today call human rights or oppression or slavery. It's estimated that about 40% of the world at that time were slaves in some way or another. And there was corruption, as you might know, and there was a lack of character among the leaders, both in the Jewish leadership in Palestine, the Roman leaders in Palestine, and of course looking at the Caesars is a study in debauchery and other kinds of evil. But Jesus did not really address that from the standpoint of politics. He was not a candidate. He did not, even though he was accused of it, actually, he did not advocate the overthrow of an existing system or even the reform of the existing government systems. He was aware of politics, though, and it isn't as if there was nothing recorded. I think we can understand from what he did and didn't say what his attitude about it was. It's interesting to me that as best we know from the recorded record, he never mentioned the cruelty of Herod Antipas toward those babies, those male babies, 2 years old and younger, that were killed at the time of his own birth. I think he must have known about that. Surely Mary and Joseph would have told him about what a terrible atrocity. Genocide would be a word we'd use today for that. But he never mentioned that as some kind of an example or counterexample or a reason for making a change in the world. There were those who mentioned to him the cruelty of Pilate toward those Jews whose blood he mingled with their sacrifices. Jesus acknowledged it barely, but went and made a spiritual lesson out of it and actually asked them another question not so much related to that. I would say he took little note of it. It's interesting that he called Herod a fox. I don't understand fully what that's about, but the context is interesting. It was a death threat. They came to Jesus and said, you know, Herod's trying to kill you. And you know what he said? Interesting. He said, you go tell that fox that a prophet cannot perish outside Jerusalem. What's the implication of that sentence? He was going to die. Yeah, okay. Yeah, a death threat? All right. Yep, that's the way it's going to work, but it'll happen in Jerusalem, as we know that it did. He was challenged about whether he was loyal to the Roman Empire or rebel against the Roman Empire. That was the challenge of those Jews near the end of his life. And he just said, well, that's a different realm, I think is a way of saying that. Give Caesar's things to Caesar. And even in the face of Pilate, who had power of life and death over him, as he said to Pilate, yes, you have power. That's for sure. God has given you the position you have. It was given to you from above. He didn't necessarily say, and you shouldn't have it, or I'm trying to take it away, or my followers will take care of you once I'm gone. He just said, that's the system and the way it is. So he said much, very little. Interesting, too, that he had an opportunity about 2 years into his ministry to be made a king. They came to make him king, a political leader. And what great things could he be accomplished in the world as a king with magical powers to feed people? Right, and to take care of his enemies. What could he have done as a political and military leader? But he just withdrew. He did not take advantage of that. However, there's one discussion of earthly power that I think is informative, and that's what we're going to look at this morning. And I'll read that verse to you. It's verse 26 of Matthew 20, or 25, sorry. Jesus said this to his disciples, you know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and those who are great exercise authority over them. Now, that's in the middle of a story, and I'll come back and look at the story and the teaching that surrounds this verse, but I want to stare at this for just a minute and see what we can learn from the words that are there and the implications, especially in the context of the question that this verse came from. Understand the word Gentiles really is a Hebrew word for peoples. It's the Greek word ethnos. It's the word that is translated Gentiles often when it's in contrast to God's people and then the nations. But it really just means the rest of the world, the races, the populations, the peoples. In fact, there are verses where it's not clearly trying to distinguish between Jew and Gentile, where it's just translated correctly in the English, peoples, nations of the earth. And so it's just saying in human affairs, all throughout the nations, this is the way things are. The rulers of the Gentiles, the nations. And I'll try to use the word nations probably the rest of the sermon because I think that's the implication. And the word rulers is a noun. The rulers, remember that's a noun, and it's the word archontes, at least the way the endings work in this particular setting. And you recognize arch, probably, right? Archbishop or archangel, it means first. It's the most important, the one who's leader, the one who is the most high ranking in power and in authority. It's a noun. He describes the people who are in that position of ruler, first in rank or power. They lord it over or exercise lordship. And the word is a compound Greek word, kata, which means over or against. It doesn't mean with or helping, okay? It means in some ways in opposition to someone or in some way suppressing or ruling over them. And then the word lord, you might recognize kyrios, the word for lord, in the second part of that Greek word. And so it means to be a master over, against. So the implication is that these leaders are not working for the benefit of those whom they lead. They are actually over them in some particular way, not necessarily to the benefit of those whom they lead. And then the word ones or great ones, the words one is, I supplied that. Some translations put that in there if you look and see. And while great is an adjective, it has the article in front of it, which really means it's acting as a noun. Y'all know what I mean by that? When I say a great thing, that's an adjective. But when I want to say the great, you see what I'm treating that adjective as a noun, the great. And so we kind of put in those that are great or the great ones. So again, it's pointing to a position or authority. And you would probably recognize the word mega in that. I think that's a word the young folks may use sometimes. Probably in different ways. Well, this is megaloi, which is plural for that word mega. That is the great. Again, an adjective used as a noun. And finally, in the second part of that, there's the exercise authority over, and there's the kata again in the beginning. And it really means more generally to have or wield, meaning usually authority or full privilege over others. Exercise authority. The great ones exercise authority. So if I were to think about what this means with regard to the nations, that is how rule, how hierarchies work in the nations, the rest of the world, we might say, among the peoples, I would say this. There are a limited number of top positions. Y'all know that? You ever seen an org chart? I know I've seen people try to turn them upside down and pretend that the CEO is the servant of everybody else. I hope he acts that way, but that ain't the way it works, really, right? There's a pyramid, and you know pyramids get narrower at the top. And I put in this org chart over there on the right what the apostles, perhaps, especially James and John, if you look at the story we're about to study, were probably thinking. Who's at the top? Only one person. Now, how many right hands and left hands does he have? Well, there's only two. So the next layer down would be those who sit. And you could almost imagine the apostles in some picture of an earthly kingdom gathered in some ceremonial arrangement. And unless we're working in 3D somehow or another, there's really only two spots that are right next to Jesus. You see the idea? And that's true in an organization. How much staff can you really have that can be effective? And after that, everybody else is the next layer down. You get that. So there are a limited number of top positions. And because in general, people in the fallen world are mostly self-centered, there are differences of opinion. And I don't even think it has to be because of greed or evil or bad motives. Y'all know that in this room, there are differences of opinion about certain things. Wearing masks comes to mind. I don't know why, right? But we all have different ideas about how things should be done. And we differ, and we might even be well motivated, but somebody's got to make the final decision. You know how that works, right? Because there's differences of opinion, then the conflict creates winners and losers. You see that? I mean, if I get my way, then I win, and you don't get your way. You see that? Or vice versa. So in this particular system, there are going to be winners and losers. And not only that, sometimes, especially in organizations, in the military, and especially in governments, there will be carnal power required to enforce this decision-making. You understand that? In a corporation, you don't obey the corporate policies. There are discipline measures that have to be followed. In the land here, we pass laws. Some people don't like them. They don't want to be forced to have a vaccine, for example. So there has to be some measure of enforcement that comes along. See, there's a disagreement. You might say they're winners and losers. I have to put that in quotes, right? And then there has to be some level of enforcement to make that happen. Romans 13, in discussing human authorities, in a favorable way, actually, they wield the sword not in vain, right? Or they bear the sword not in vain, is the way Paul describes those who are put in place by God to exercise authority, especially over evil or criminals in some way. And so some carnal power is required to enforce this decision or these things in which people disagree and someone has to make the call. And inevitably, in this situation, the great ones are served. That is, their interests usually have precedent, right? Because they're in the positions of authority. So they make the calls that actually favor what they would want, maybe enrich themselves in the worst case, but also their judgment is followed, things that might benefit them or their family is followed, including especially getting and staying in that position of power. And if you notice in our election system, there are decisions made. I suppose somebody's thinking about the good of everybody, but most of them are made related to how do I stay in power, meaning get the most votes in the next cycle. Y'all see that. And that really makes one point that I wanted to say, and that is, this is independent of the governmental system. I'm not talking about that. You understand, you can see how this would work in a dictatorship. I mean, it seems obvious there, right? But think about the most liberal, inclusive democracy you have. There's still only one, you know, chief officer, and there's still a law that has to be made, just one, and it's got to be enforced in some way. You see that? And there's some way of selecting the leaders, and that's done to some extent, to the exclusion of others, and there'll be parties, and some will lose, and some will win. Do you see all this applies in any system? Certainly in the corporate world, if you've lived there for very long, you know that there are positions of great power. And that power might not just be political or military power. It might be the power of wealth, right? It might be the power of influence. And if you think about this org chart there, what greater position of influence could there be besides right up next to Jesus, the King of the universe, the Messiah, the anointed one in whom all history and the prophecies were pointing to? You see that? So this is not really dependent on, I'm not talking about governmental systems, and I'm not talking about one party or the other, please. I'm not talking about that. I'm saying that in the nations, in the peoples of the earth, that's the way things work. And I think that's true in any organization, really, in which there are multiple people and rules have to be made and someone has to be in charge. That's just the way it works. But it shall not be so among you. That's the next thing Jesus says. So whatever we've just learned about, I think he is saying, by contrast, that's not us. That is not us. So, let's look at the story. The context of Matthew 20, this incident, is that it's in the last year of Jesus' life, if we count his life kind of measured by the Passovers as listed in John. So it's well after probably the feeding of the 5,000. Well, maybe not well after, but maybe a few weeks or months after that. But certainly not down quite to the time of the cross, but getting close. As a matter of fact, Jesus has set his face toward Jerusalem. That's a phrase that Luke uses several times to suggest that there was some point in Jesus' ministry and his travels and journeys that he just turned, and then from then on, whether he was directly headed that way or not, his intent was to get to Jerusalem and to do his going out, as he talked about with Moses and Elijah, his final purpose. And so during that time, he was plainly predicting his death. And those explanations occur probably at least three times in all of the synoptic gospel accounts. So you'll find them in Luke. And here I've listed those in Matthew in chapter 16, chapter 17, and then the very verses before our text begins says the very same thing. He's telling them plainly. Maybe it was somehow cryptic before, but as we read the words, it seems clear that he is actually saying it as plainly as he can. Speaking of speaking plainly, I don't have to wear this mask, do I? Okay. Nobody's nodding one way or the other, but I'll put it back. Okay, thank you. That would be helpful. I'll get more oxygen. This will even go faster, maybe, if I do that. And in addition to those very plain predictions of his death, he says back in Matthew 16, not too far back in time, that if you want to follow him, he must take up his cross and follow me. I wonder what they were thinking about that. So it's very clear Jesus' death was on his mind, and we'll see it in this story as well. There are a few other details I want to cover just because I think it'll help us understand the text a little bit. It sheds a little bit of light on the interaction between James and John and Jesus. Remember Peter's confession in Matthew 16 that Jesus was the Christ, the Son of God. Ended up, Jesus said some more things. And he said, I'll build my church and the kingdom. And he says, I will give to you, Peter, the keys of the kingdom. Now, I don't know if that created jealousy, or if maybe they all understood he meant you, as in Peter and everybody else is going to be equal. But in any case, there was some sense of key ownership of the kingdom that was promised to Peter back just a couple of chapters before, maybe only a few weeks before this incident. And then there's this repeated, and it seems like continual, and often in the background, and surely on their minds all the time, about which of them was the greatest. You remember those verses? You can look up some of those. It's in all the accounts. And perhaps explains John 13, Jesus' washing of the disciples' feet, as a kind of a final thing. Listen, this is your attitude toward one another. Anyway, all through it, in Luke's account, he kind of says, well, what were y'all talking about on the way? To suggest that it's going on in private, right? But he still needs to address it. It's always going on about which would be the greatest. Some other teaching is that the rich young ruler came in the previous chapter, Matthew 19, and there was a discussion about, you know, he went away, sorrowful, he's a man of many possessions. And then he said, it's hard for the rich to enter heaven. And then Peter, I guess, thinking, well, we've given up everything, so we must be going to get a big reward, right? That was kind of his thought about the thing. But Jesus said, well, you know, I say to you, in the regeneration, when the Son of Man sits on the throne of his glory, does that sound like greatness to you? It sounds like that org chart with Jesus at the top. You who have followed me will also sit on 12 thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel. Can you imagine how that sounded to them in their concept of who's the greatest and, you know, maybe some sense of privilege? Already an exclusive number of people who would be able to sit on the throne. And finally, in this teaching on discipline, Matthew 18, there's this, I think, looking forward to the time when the church would exist. And he says, you know, you bring it to the individual, then take two or three witnesses and go to the church. And then in that discussion, he ends by saying this. I say to you, if two of you agree on earth concerning anything they ask, it will be done for them by my Father in heaven. I'm getting an idea here, right? I know about the thrones. I know about the coming glorification of Jesus. And if I ask something, what does he say? If any two of you, in fact, ask something, I might give it to you. You see where this might apply in this story. Okay. Who are the characters? Well, there's James and John. They are known as the sons of Zebedee. In this text, it says their mother was the wife of, did I say that right? Of Zebedee, which is an odd way of saying it. We'll talk about why that might be so. Jesus names them Boanerges, sons of thunder. I don't fully understand that, but it suggests to me that they weren't like calm people. Maybe they were pretty aggressive, perhaps. they were part of the inner circle of Peter, James, and John, and you see that in the Transfiguration, the healing of Jairus' daughter in the garden, three incidents where the three of them seem to be closer to Jesus than the others. You remember that John, perhaps protecting the master's power and reputation, forbid the unknown miracle worker in Luke chapter 9. He said, I took care of him. I told him to stop because he was using your name. And Jesus condemned him for that. He said, no, you missed the point. And they also, James and John, the two of them together, wanted to call down fire on the Samaritans who were inhospitable to Jesus as he journeyed toward Jerusalem in Luke chapter 9. And about that inner circle, Peter, James, and John, you know, Peter had his moment related to that. In one of those very clear predictions of Jesus' death, Peter says, no, it's not going to happen to you. And Jesus said, get behind me, Satan. So Peter's already kind of made his kind of big guffaw, whoever, that's not the right word, faux pas, I think is the right word, right up here. But here, James and John are going to come in this story. And then she's called the mother of Zebedee's sons. By comparing some verses that have to do with the women at the cross and later at the caring for the body, or the intent to care for the body, it's pretty clear that her name was Salome. Not the bad Salome later, but this earlier, but the good one. And it seems like that phrasing, the mother of Zebedee's sons, would indicate that she was a widow. Otherwise, it just seems like the text might have just said their mother. But anyway, that's the way it's worded. And it's clear that maybe in her widowhood, she was one of those women that supported and followed with Jesus all the time. So very close to him, respectful of him, understanding what he taught for the most part, including the things we just talked about. She appears to be devout and followed him even where the disciples did not, the apostles did not, followed him to the foot of the cross. And she comes to him with a respectful attitude, kneeling down, probably not necessarily specifically in worship, but out of respect, as you would toward a king, a future king for sure. And she makes a request, not, can I be your right-hand person, right? Because we need to have women in high positions of authority. She doesn't ask that. She asks that her sons, my two sons, these two sons of mine, sit one on your right hand and the other on your left in your kingdom. Now, do you see the significance of that in light of the context that was presented there? What do you think about this request? I think at the very outset, you have to admit this was an expression of her faith, don't you? You know, he's not in his kingdom yet, right? Maybe there's lots to happen before he gets to that kingdom, but she's confident it'll happen. And it'll be successful. And it'll be full of glory, power, and respect. And he's promised that. You've seen those promises even this morning in what we've looked at, and she believes in that. And I think you could argue it's consistent with what she maybe heard Jesus say. The 12 were supposed to sit on thrones. If two agree and they ask anything, it'll be done for them. That's all she's doing, is asking for those positions of authority. And I think it's likely, thinking that her two sons were probably the best of all the apostles, and I would think that too if my two sons were in the apostleship, right? That it was best for the kingdom that if they were just put in higher positions than the others. Because they'd be good servants, they'd be good rulers. And she believed that about them. That's a guess. I just like to say that. But I think you have to see this request is not really such an evil, scheming kind of thing. It wouldn't be consistent with her character to ask for that kind of thing. And yet, it did reflect a worldly view, didn't it? Really? Just we talked about. That is, there's limited positions at the top. And one of the biggest evidences for that, if you skip down to verse 24, it just made the others really mad. It wasn't some kind of generous expression that they all admired for her deep faith. They got mad about it. In fact, there's two Greek words there. They were exceeding grievous or something like that. We'll get to that. But they were upset about it. And of course, the reason is because it represented a limited opportunity. And if they, James and John, got the right hand and the left hand spots, guess who didn't get the right hand and left hand spots? It cut the others out. And not only that, when she said grant that these, in fact, she starts by saying, I have a request that will you grant it? And Jesus, of course, And by the way, never do that. When someone says, you know, is there something you will do for me, right? Or you promise me something. You see the difficulty in that. No, wait. Let's hear what it is first. I don't think she was trying to trick Jesus at all that. But he does say, well, you tell me what it is. But what she wanted was for him to grant. And perhaps that giving and granting was bypassing a fair selection and qualification process. You see what I mean? Isn't that the ideal thing if you're an earthly ruler among the nations? Is you just get it because you're the son of the king, right? Or you're just the inheritor of the fortune that your father and his grandfather left you. You didn't earn anything. You just got it, right? Or because you're the cousin of somebody. And by the way, some indication she might have been the sister of Mary, the mother of Jesus. There's a little bit of hint of that. You know what? We need to appoint our relatives, first of all, don't we? There's a little bit of a hint of nepotism there. And I'll just say to you, you look around the world, those places where rulers are selected based on not being qualified, just being selected, right, or because they're the friend of Bill or whatever it is, that's the recipe for disaster because there's no... And it may be she's just saying, look, let's bypass all this, who's going to earn it and all that kind of stuff. Let's just go ahead and announce it now in advance so we got that out of the way. We don't have to go through an election or some kind of process. And, of course, it was preemptive in this sense. The others didn't think of it soon enough, right? Jesus got there first. They were maybe thinking, well, let's see how this kingdom thing works out, and then we'll sort it out. And meanwhile, we'll argue over who's the greatest, but in this case, she got there first. And that may be what made them mad. I don't know. Do you see in this the nations, the way the nations think about greatness? And by greatness, maybe I should have defined that, but I mean the one who gets to make the decision. The one whose benefit is preeminent because they're in a position of authority. The one who gets the glory, the recognition. The one who in some way is respected above the others because of that position. It's amazing how that happens. Someone who gets to be a famous person because they've written a few songs with three guitar chords and stuff in them. And somehow or another they're respected way above others and have a say-so and other. It's odd the way the nations work, but that's the way it is. Right. And so you see that despite her character, her motives, even the approach that she makes, there's something worldly. There's something about the way the nations are. How did Jesus respond? There were times where Jesus said, "Get behind me, Satan." Right? You know what I'm talking about? Where the action was so opposed to what he had in mind. And maybe the character of the person was revealed in such a way that I'll not ramble about that except just to say, I just imagine if you were in the presence of Jesus on a continual basis, which we ought to think of ourselves, it might not be pleasant all the time. You know, I think it wouldn't be pleasant much of the time, actually, because of our shortcomings. Peter falls down and says, "Depart from me. I'm a sinful man." You see, and Jesus, who knows our hearts, who looks right at us, but how does he respond? It's interesting to me that he does not say no. No. Wrong request. That's bad. Shouldn't have asked that. That's not what he says. In fact, he actually excuses in some ways her request by just basically saying, "You don't really know what you ask." A side point here, in Mark's account, there's no mention of their mother coming, but even in the Mark's response, he says, "You," plural, right? So it's pretty clear Jesus is looking at James and John, who had something to do with this. It wasn't just Salome, and saying, y'all don't know what y'all are asking, right? You guys have got it wrong. And so to some extent, he excuses them because they just are confused, and the request might be well motivated, but misunderstood. And then he asks them a question. "Are you able to drink the cup that I'm about to drink and be baptized with the baptism that I'm about to be baptized with?" And there's no doubt that has to do with this crucifixion. If you have time, look over to Luke 12:50, another reference where Jesus just calls the crucifixion. "I have a baptism with which I must be baptized." He's talking about his death, right, at this point. And, of course, their immediate answer is, "Of course, we're able." And it reminds me of Peter, who said, "Yes, if everyone forsakes you, I won't, you know." at the Last Supper. Of course, the one who was about to betray him three times just within that very night. But of course, they just say, yes, we're ready, we're able, not really knowing even what they're asking or what they're agreeing to in verse 22. But then in verse 23, Jesus, I think, again, in great sympathy for their misunderstanding and maybe in some sense to help prepare them and develop them as he was trying to do in this last year, he says, well, yeah, you will, actually. You will. And Acts 12:1, James is killed with the sword by Herod. Different Herod, I think. And in Revelation 1:9, John describes himself as a outcast or a prisoner of the Lord. I can't remember the exact wording, but he is in exile as an older man for the cause of Christ. Yeah, they did. They did, as did the other 12. Yes, that's coming, Jesus says. And then he says this. But to sit on my right hand and on my left hand is not mine to give, but it is for those whom it is prepared by my Father. If you look at your text there, the better translations will note that it is for those is not in the Greek text. I hope you have italics there, because those words are just supplied in the translations that I think aim more toward accuracy. And really, this seems to be pretty good consistency. So what this is saying is he's not saying I can't give it to you. I'm powerless. I don't have the ability to give that to you. That's not what he's saying. If you take out that phrase and then use instead the word but and take out the comma, which is in our English punctuation, he says it's not mine to give, except for him whom is prepared by my Father. You see that? He's not saying I can't give it to you. He's saying I can't give it to anybody except those who have been prepared by my Father. That's what he's saying. There's some preparation of heart, of attitude, of life experience that makes people able to receive this from Jesus, receive greatness, to sit on his right hand and on his left hand, I guess we might even say in this context. What is it about us that What is it that God does to prepare us so that we can accept this gift from this gift of greatness? Well, the 10, I think that was not the end of that little interchange. And then maybe a few minutes or hours, I don't know, passed. But you can just imagine the 10. Did you hear what they did? Have you heard? Did you know what they did? And so there's this anger growing among the 10. And again, Jesus doesn't rebuke them. In some strong sense, because I think they don't understand, as we don't understand, I would add. And so he calls them to himself. They were greatly displeased, two words, with, interesting, their brethren. And, of course, this was an outgrowth of the ongoing controversy, and they probably felt they'd been outmaneuvered and preempted, and they saw it as a limited opportunity, which that maybe they had lost because Salome had come in before them. And Jesus says, come, y'all gather in, right? Let's have a huddle here. We got to talk about this for just a second. And so he calls them near to himself. And I think, again, out of love, out of an understanding of their misunderstandings. And then that's where the teaching that we looked at earlier fits. And I'm sorry I did this out of order. I hope it fits there. But that's where Jesus said, this is how the nations rule. That's where he stuck it in. And so instead of rebuking them right away, he says, listen, I want you to think about the world. I want you to think about the nations and the way rule and hierarchy and authority and glory and often oppression happens in the world. He sticks it in right there. That's what he says to them in preparation for what he's about to say, which is this. Yet, it shall not be so among you. You're different. That's not the way you live. You are not of the nations. Whoever desires to become great among you, let him be your servant. Whoever desires to be first among you, let him be your slave. Let's look at those words particularly. Again, there's this reference to greatness, the mega word, but here it really is a pure adjective. It's not the great, it is whoever wants to have the quality of greatness. You see the difference there? It's an adjective. Whoever wants to become great among you, a pure adjective, not a position, right? You see the difference. As it, among the other reference there. And to become great or high or large or mighty or whatever, let him be your servant. That word servant is diakonos. You recognize that as the same root word that's used for what we call deacons, but it just means a servant, an attendant, a minister, a waiter. We see that word used in Acts chapter 6 for those who would serve the widows at the tables there. And so it's a servant. So if you want to achieve the attribute of greatness, then you take the position of a servant. You see how that's flipped over from the other? In the other, you want the position, you get to do these things. See? And again, similarly, and whoever desires to be first, again, an adjective. And there's, instead of ark, it's protos. That is first, best, chief, foremost, at the front of the line, he says. Whoever wants to have that quality about them, he says, would become your slave. And that's the simple word, bond slave. Someone who's owned by another. Someone who has no ownership rights of their own. That's the word he uses. You see, so he moves from a kind of a servant attitude to one who's actually fully owned by another with no rights of their own. Are you challenged by that teaching? And what he's saying is that really the kingdom is not, his kingdom, is not about positions, grasping for those narrow spots at the top where your will gets to be put over the will of others. No, it's the other way around, right? You aspire to the position of a servant, and that gives you the quality of greatness or firstness. And the same thing with the idea of being a slave, someone owned by another. I want to compare that then to the qualities of the rulers of the nations. They're limited top positions. What kind of limits are there to how many people can be servants in the kingdom? Right? You got to get a ticket at the door and we only have so many. No, I don't think so. It's a limitless opportunity as we think about what we can do for others. And in the conflicts between our wills, I wanted to do it this way, but the elders or somebody in authority in the kingdom said, I have to do this. No, actually, in my service to others, I'm not worried about what is inconvenient to me or what I would have chosen differently because I probably know better. No, that's not it at all. In fact, it may be that the elders, for example, in the church or in some position of authority or maybe in my family may know a little more about it. And it could be that in my eagerness to serve, I hadn't seen those opportunities to do something that really wouldn't have been my favorite thing. In fact, it inconvenienced me. In fact, it cost me a lot of money. And yet, it's an opportunity to serve others that's been given to me. And I have that. And then, of course, if power is used to require me to serve others, right? So it's not a matter of wielding the sword, right? Or withholding my raise or some economic advantage if I go along with the leader. No, it's self-motivated service. It's not required in that way. And then the benefit of the great ones are served. No, actually, the very opposite. The great ones, adjective great, mean those who are great in quality, sacrificially discard their own benefit. And you know where this passage is going about the Son of Man and what he did, right? No, they eagerly, sacrificially discard their rights as a slave, discard their self-interest as a servant to others. And so there's no conflict, something that has to be enforced. And then the idea of getting and staying in power, which seems to be just a difficult thing in the nations of the world. But here, God actually prepared this. You notice that in what Jesus said? That for what God has prepared. He prepared that position for us to be in. And he preserves it, I think, in the kingdom. And so you see what a great contrast between the nations and the kingdom. Do we ever think in this way, like the nations? I should point that way, I think. Is that ever our attitude in our life, in our relationships with others, and certainly within the church? Jesus says, you know what? Whenever you think that way, think of this. The Son of Man, that's Jesus, did not come to be served, but to serve, give his life a ransom for many. We often say this. However difficult it is for you to put your own interests behind, accept maybe some level of mistreatment, sacrifice your rights, don't fully have the voice that you wish you would have in some situation where my opinion can have some sway, I just have to remember the cross and Jesus silently standing before Pilate and accepting that authority as part of God's will. And all the other things that we could say about the cross itself. Jesus came to give his life a ransom for many, is the way this story ends. What are the applications in our lives? First of all, I just need to tell you this, and you know it. The nations don't get it. Don't expect to read some book about politics or something and see some system that's going to kind of explain everything or help us understand how we should get along in the church or in our families or in our lives. No, you're not going to get it there. You will read books that will talk about defending your rights or how to get positions of power or how to do what makes you happy or how to win friends and influence people. In other words, it will be about how I get my way, how I can be glorified in this life. That's kind of the idea of the nations. That's the way the world works. I meant to say this before. I don't think Jesus necessarily condemns that as evil. I may have said that before, but I think he's just saying that's the way the world is. That's the way it operates. In a fallen world, that's about the best we can do. And maybe in a democracy, we'll all point our guns, which we have the rights to own, at one another to make sure nobody gets too much power. Maybe that's the idea. I don't know. But that's just the way the nations think. That's the way they work. Yet, it shall not be so among you. And the nations won't get it. I think they'll look at Christians and say, I don't get those people. They let people run over them. They're not really concerned about whether they have a voice or not, right? They're actually not worried about their own tribe and their own rights and those kind of things. They're interested in serving others. And look at within the church that they have. It doesn't really matter who's in a position of leadership there. And I would say that religious organizations that create positions and hierarchies that look like the nations, you know what I might be talking about with archbishops, for example? I don't think they're Jesus' kingdom. Jesus said, my kingdom isn't that way. If I'm creating a position where people have authority and they enforce the rules over other people, that isn't it. Jesus says, it shall not be so among you in my kingdom. And I think even as we look at our elders, and they are called rulers. Look at Hebrews chapter 13, verses 7 and 17, for example. But they're not like the nation's rulers. It says in that passage, they don't do that to watch for themselves. It doesn't even say that they're rulers so the church will have orderly decisions made. Do you notice that? Look carefully at that passage. It's not saying so somebody can make the call about COVID restrictions. That's not the role of elders. It says they watch in behalf of our souls. Whose interest in mind? It's others. They're servants who are trying to get us to heaven. That's what they do. And we sometimes see elders as something like they're the CEOs or something, some position of authority. And I remember as an elder being made very uncomfortable, even when people would make jokes about, well, be careful, there's an elder in the room, as if I had some kind of a power or authority or frightening kind of way of imposing and forcing things. No, they're here to watch in behalf of our souls. They're not like the nations. I could say more about that. The other thing is, too, that as we look at ourselves in relationship to maybe our activities as a group or even in our families or other relationships, our opportunities for position of power, defending our personal rights, equal recognition, say so, maybe equal or better in decisions, that's what the nations seek. I think that's what we just saw. And my question to you is, as you want to be represented or want to have equal say-so or want to have your rights protected, is that so you can serve others or is it for the benefit that I might receive or to protect myself from some abuse that I might suffer? Is that my motive? Which is it? What do the nations do? They want those positions for self-interest as opposed to having an opportunity for service to others. I think it's often the case that those maybe who are in an oppressed class, and I'm sounding Marxist now, but, you know, in some ways they have a better opportunity for service because of where they are and less opportunity for the temptation to aspire to greatness or even greater positions of authority. I think it maybe mostly applies in our personal relationships, in our relationships to our wives or wives to their husbands, parents to their children, children to their parents, siblings to one another, brethren who sit across the pew. Are we aspiring to the positions of servant and slave. Remember, the position gives us the quality of greatness and firstness. I wonder sometimes when we get in an argument, those of you husbands and wives, I know you never have disagreements and argue about things, but just imagine that you had one recently, right? Think particularly about what it was over, what it was about, what was the issue at stake. Were you arguing for the benefit of the other person or your own benefit in that argument? Were you expecting to come out of that with more opportunity and advantage or less? What was your goal? To find what was best for that person as a slave or a servant, or maybe what was best for you, or more convenient to me, or my say-so got heard finally, or, and so on. Oh, what a challenge. Are y'all challenged by this? I don't live this way. I'm sorry. I have to repent more often than I need to, but it's hard. And why? Because the world doesn't get it. The nations don't get this. Read any books about relationships, marriage in particular, but others. Children, the same way. When you've had a dispute with your parents because they disagree with you on, is it because you wanted to help them? You wanted to make their life easier? You wanted to help them accomplish the goals they had? You see what we're saying? It's just hard. It's hard to do, to think that way. But among you, it shall not be so, Jesus says. We're not like the nations. I hope you've been challenged by Matthew 20. That's what I wanted to say about it. There probably is more. I can only wring the washcloth so hard, and we'll get what we can out of it. But I think that's the case. So I think in some ways you have to remember the last thing Jesus said in this interchange. The Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and give his life a ransom for many. This is, you probably don't recognize it, and I didn't think I did till I looked into it. This is a kind of an exciting verse among those who study Jesus' teaching. And because this concept of a ransom, as far as we know, has not appeared in Jesus' teaching up to this point. It's kind of a new idea that's introduced here. And you probably know it gets developed even more as the New Testament revelation progresses or grows. Jesus is saying, I am come ultimately, really, to give up everything, my life, my whole life, right? And now, remember, this is in, like, the trump card over what he's asking us to do, which seems impossibly hard to do. But he says, I'm come to give my whole life. Why? As a payment. A payment. You could almost think about someone who's been kidnapped and needs to have some money given to them, although that doesn't quite fit, because it's not like he's paying this ransom to Satan, per se. But there certainly is a substitutionary price that's being paid in what Jesus is doing. And so it's not just to free us from our sins, but in this context, I think, to give us that example, which stands before us. And no other religion or system of philosophy has this example before it to say, I'm asking you to be very different, not like the nations, because you look at me, the leader, the king, the one who's at the top, who is the ultimate servant, the ultimate slave, who gave up his own life to make a payment on our behalf. Do you see that? And that's the invitation this morning. If you haven't taken advantage of that ransom, we'd encourage you to come and do that. If you've studied and you know what to do, to repent and be baptized in water for the remission of your sins, as we learn later in the revelation of God, we'd encourage you to do that. But all of us, I think, can look at this teaching and say, how can I be more like the kingdom follower that Jesus wants me to be in our lives? So if there's something we all need to do in some way, let's do it while we're standing and sing.